Oh, why did I have to fall in love with such a fool?
I ran into a story for you, a front page story.
Gus, you're a dear, sweet boy, and you'll bring my little present.
You're listening to The Pictures Got Small, an appreciation podcast for the glamorous and sometimes dark history of old Hollywood. Hosted by Francesca Luisi.
I happen to know the police are looking for this car.
Oh, dear, I hoped you wouldn't.
You heard me say no, didn't you? Well, that's what I mean.
See here. I told you I wasn't asking anything from anybody. I can take care of myself.
Maybe you have, but if you think I want to stay cooped up in this place any longer than I have to...
This is one of the biggest stories that's cracked in a long time. I've simply got to get it to my paper.
No worry about that. We've got all the time in the world.
Welcome to The Pictures Got Small. I'm your host, Francesca Luisi, and thank you for joining me for episode 2. This is our Christmas episode, and so of course we have to cover a Christmas movie. So today we will be diving into the story of the making of It's a Wonderful Life. This episode is going to go up on December 20th, 2020, which will be 74 years from the day that It's a Wonderful Life had its world premiere at the Globe Theater in New York City, which is a story unto itself, but we'll get into that later. It's a Wonderful Life is what I believed to have been a universally beloved holiday classic, but boy, was I wrong about that. My research turned up that people really hate this movie. Which surprised me, but we'll get into that later. I do address some of the criticisms at the end of the episode. But yeah, I'm not of that opinion. I love this film. I always say that I saw it at a time when I needed to see it. I was maybe 15 or 16 the first time I saw it in its entirety. And I was going through a rough patch. I was in a bad headspace. And it touched me. It just struck a chord with me. I remember we were watching it on a channel that had commercials. And every commercial break, I'd run into the bathroom and cry and then run back outside so I wouldn't miss the film. Yeah, I mean, I watch it at least twice a year. I can't get through it without crying. I mean, from the opening credits to the end credits, my eyes are rimmed with tears. It just means a lot to me, and it really had a profound effect on me. I think about it at least once a day. Something will remind me of a line from it or a scene. So yeah, I'm surprised that people feel that way about it. But to each their own. Also, I just want to say thank you to everyone who took the time to listen to episode 1 on the making of Some Like It Hot. I've gotten nothing but positive feedback from that episode, and it means so much to me. I've been wanting to do a podcast for so long, but I didn't think anybody would listen to it, and who would want to hear me talk. So just the fact that I have any listeners at all, it really makes me feel good about what I'm doing and all the hard work that goes into making these episodes. So yeah, thank you for that. Also, before we get started, I just want to mention my friends over at Hidden Hollywood. It's a YouTube channel that you should be subscribed to if you like all things old Hollywood and deep dives into old Hollywood history. They've got 2 episodes up on their YouTube channel right now, one on the death of Natalie Wood and another on the death of Thelma Todd. And I have it on good authority that they have a 3rd episode coming up soon about old Hollywood rumors. So yeah, check them out on YouTube. Make sure you subscribe to their channel. Tell them The Pictures Got Small sent you. And yeah, if you like this show, you'll definitely like their content. Okay, so without further ado, please join me for the story of the making of It's a Wonderful Life. Writer Philip Van Doren Stern first wrote his short story, The Greatest Gift, in 1939, and, after failing to get it picked up by a publisher, paid to have 200 copies made himself. Stern sent the 20-some-odd page booklet out with his Christmas cards later that year. In Stern's original story, ordinary small-town man George Pratt is on the brink of suicide, about to jump off of a bridge when he is approached by a kind stranger, to whom George expresses his wish to have never been born. The stranger, who is never given a name, tells George that his wish has been granted and that he should return home and pretend to be a door-to-door brush salesman. Upon his return, George finds that no one knows him, and that all of his friends are worse off for not having known him. Harry, George's beloved younger brother that he saved during a boyhood swimming accident, drowned. His wife, Mary, married to another man. The young boy who should be his and Mary's son points a gun at George and asks, "You're dead. Why won't you die?" George races back to the bridge where he first encountered the stranger, who explains to George that he had already been given the greatest gift, life. George begs to be brought back, and the man undoes his magic, returning George's life to normal. Though the fundamentals of the story are the same, Stern's version is missing many of the staples from the film. There was no Mr. Potter, no Gower's Drugstore, and no Bedford Falls, to name a few. The story came to the attention of someone at RKO, and in April 1944, the studio bought the rights from Stern for $10,000 with the intention of turning it into a Christmas movie for their top star at the time, Cary Grant. The studio commissioned spec scripts from three of the most popular writers of the time, Clifford Odets, Dalton Trumbo, and Mark Connelly. Trumbo had written the first draft, which saw George Bailey as an idealistic political hopeful who contemplated suicide after losing an election. In Trumbo's version, George was visited by an angel who showed him what life would have been like had he become a businessman instead of pursuing a career in politics. Where without George, the compassionate politician, Bedford Falls went from a charming small town to a polluted, commercialized modern city. There was no need for a Mr. Potter, as George Bailey himself had become the greedy old man who was turning a profit while his hometown fell to ruins. Connelly's script included two George Baileys, and instead of being shown a world where he was never born, George sees what life would have been like if a bad version of him existed instead. Odets expanded on this idea, having the two Georges fight to the death in a climactic battle on the bridge, with good George killing bad George. Odets' only contribution to make it into the final script was the scene where young George Bailey prevents Mr. Gower from poisoning a child with the wrong medication. RKO wasn't happy with any of the scripts and decided to shelve the project entirely. Cary Grant went on to make a different Christmas staple, The Bishop's Wife, where he played an angel that comes to Earth to provide divine guidance to David Niven. Before World War II, Frank Capra, who had already served in World War I, established himself as one of the most popular and successful directors in Hollywood, having already made notable classics It Happened One Night, which was the first film ever to win all of the major awards at the Oscars, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, and Arsenic and Old Lace. With the exception of the latter, Capra had won Best Directing Oscars for each of those films. Capra had become known for making wholesome films with uplifting messages and an emphasis on sentimentality. His critics called his movies Capricorns, a critique that never bothered the director, who felt that making movies with positive statements was important. "I always felt the world cannot fall apart as long as free men see the rainbow, feel the rain, and hear the laughter of a child," he once said. But Capra had been away for 5 years. Within just 4 days of Pearl Harbor, Capra, then 44 years old, left Hollywood behind and volunteered for a position in the Army. Of his willingness to serve his adopted country, as Capra was born in Sicily and immigrated to America in 1903, he would later say, "I had a guilty conscience. In my films, I championed the cause of the gentle, the poor, the downtrodden. Yet I had begun to live like Aga Khan. The curse of Hollywood is big money. It comes so fast, it breeds and imposes its own wars, not of wealth, but of ostentation and phony status." When he returned from the military, Capra, along with fellow directors and World War II veterans, George Stevens and William Wyler, founded their own independent film studio, Liberty Films, in April 1945. Creating their own studio was a huge move at the time, as up until then, directors were considered to just be studio employees who should do what their bosses told them to. With his own studio, Capra opened himself up to more avenues of creative freedom. Liberty signed on to a 9-picture distribution deal with RKO, and Capra's next project would be the first film under this contract. It was my first picture after being in the army for about 5 years, Capra recalled. I was scared to death. What would my first film be about? It certainly wasn't going to be about war. I had my belly full of war, and I came out a terrific pacifist. So what would it be about? Charles Korner, RKO's executive vice president, came up to me and he said, I've got just the story. We've got three scripts on it. Three powerhouse guys have written scripts on this thing, and they missed the idea. What idea? I asked. And he said, the idea I got when I bought this Christmas card. In about 9 paragraphs, there was this story. A man who was a failure was given the opportunity to come back and see the world as it would have been had he not been born. And he finds out that no man is a failure. Well, my goodness, this thing hit me like a ton of bricks. This was, to me, novel, new, and a wonderfully humane way of pinning this idea down, the importance of the individual, which has always been the main theme of all of my films. The idea of one man seeing how his life touched the lives of so many others deeply moved Capra, and Stern's story definitely reads like a Frank Capra film. In fact, Capra had already tackled the near suicide of a desperate man who is saved by those who love him in 1941's Meet John Doe with Gary Cooper. Capra purchased the rights to The Greatest Gift from RKO, who sold it to him for the same $10,000 that they had paid for it, throwing in the 3 spec scripts for free. Capra began working on his own version of the screenplay, a first for the director, which he renamed It's a Wonderful Life. He brought in Academy Award-nominated husband and wife duo Albert Hackett and Frances Goodrich to help him iron out the script. The couple had already penned well-known films The Thin Man, After the Thin Man, 7 Brides for 7 Brothers, and Father of the Bride, all of which brought them Oscar nominations. Hackett and Goodrich's script combined some minor elements from the previous drafts, but they fleshed out the story, adding in new scenes and breathing life into Bedford Falls and its colorful inhabitants, including Mr. Potter and Clarence, who was reworked from the stranger of the original story into George Bailey's guardian angel. In earlier drafts of the script, the scene where George saves Harry originally took place during an ice hockey game on Mr. Potter's property, as Potter looked on. When the puck went out of bounds and crossed a no trespassing sign, Potter unleashed his guard dogs on the boys, during which time Harry falls through the ice and is saved by George, who loses hearing in one ear in the aftermath. Another scene that eventually changed was the film's ending, which originally consisted of George falling to his knees on the bridge after being brought back to reality and reciting the Lord's Prayer. Capra nixed this idea as he felt that relying too heavily on religious elements would take away from the emotional impact of George's family and friends coming together to help him. Frank Capra's mantra, one man, one film, had come to be known as the Capra touch, which basically meant that the director was of the opinion that there needed to be one single creative force driving the picture. As you might expect, this did not make him easy to work with. After clashing with Capra, who had a tendency to get overly involved in all aspects of his movies, Hackett and Goodrich eventually walked away from the project, but their contributions to the script laid the groundwork for the film as we know it today. Frank Capra would be condescending, and you didn't just address Frances as my dear woman, Hackett later said. We told him what we were going to do, and he said, that sounds fine. We were trying to move the story along and work it out, and then somebody told us that Capra and Joe Swerling were working on it together, and that sort of took the guts right out of it. Joe Swerling was a very close friend of ours, and when we heard what he was doing, we felt rather bad about it. We were getting near the end and word came that Capra wanted to know how soon we'd be finished. So my wife said, we're finished right now. We quickly wrote out the last scene and never saw him again after that. He's a very arrogant son of a bitch. That horrid man, Goodrich said of Capra, couldn't wait to get to writing it himself. Capra often collaborated with Joe Swerling, having turned 7 of Swerling's scripts into feature films. Though it's not clear what Swerling's contributions to It's a Wonderful Life were, the film's final script gives screenwriting credits to Capra, Hackett and Goodrich, with additional scenes credited to Swirling. The final version of the script would tell the story of a man named George Bailey, who, after dedicating his life to helping his family and friends, begins to feel as if life has passed him by. George never got to do any of the things he dreamt of as a young man. He never got to go to college, travel the world, learn how to build things, or even step foot outside of his hometown of Bedford Falls. George had to sit back and watch as life happened all around him, while he stayed behind to take over the family business, the Bailey Building and Loan. The only truly bright spot in George's life is that he got to marry his dream girl, Mary, and together they started their own family. On Christmas Eve, when $8,000 of the Bailey Building and Loan's money accidentally falls into the hands of the town's local cranky old man, Mr. Potter, George finds himself faced with the prospect of jail time. He begs Mr. Potter for help, but Potter, who has a long-standing feud with the Bailey family, refuses to help George, declaring that George's life insurance policy makes him worth more dead than alive. Feeling as though he is out of options, George decides to make good on Potter's revelation, heading to the town's bridge with the intention of killing himself. Luckily for George, his suicide attempt is thwarted by a drowning man, and George, who cannot resist helping someone, rushes to save him. Once they reach safety, the man introduces himself as Clarence Oddbody, George's guardian angel, sent to Earth to stop George from throwing away life's most precious gift. George doesn't believe a word Clarence says, but admits to wishing that he had never been born. After consulting with his heavenly constituents, Clarence tells George that his wish has been granted. He has never been born. When George returns to Bedford Falls, he finds that the town is not how he knows it to be. Even the name is different. It's now known as Pottersville. George finds that his widowed mother, who claims not to know who he is, now runs a decrepit boarding house. His brother Harry, who should have become a war hero, drowned in a childhood accident that George was supposed to save him from. His uncle Billy, George's partner in the Building and Loan, is in a mental institution. The Building and Loan closed years ago and has been replaced by a dance hall. Bailey Park, the affordable housing community George built, is a cemetery. Mr. Gower, the pharmacist George worked for as a boy, is now the town disgrace after accidentally sending the wrong medication to a sick child, killing him. A tragedy that George should have been around to prevent. Lastly, George sees that Mary, who should be his wife, has become an old maid, remaining unwed as her soulmate was never born. Realizing the importance of his life, George begs to be brought back. Order is restored, and George, so happy to be alive, runs through the streets of Bedford Falls, wishing Merry Christmas to everything and everyone he passes. The film ends with the people of Bedford Falls opening up their pocketbooks to help George raise the missing $8,000. The first half of the film is told through flashback as angels tell the story of George Bailey's life to Clarence. This technique makes the film more than just a story about one man's life, but a tour of small-town America during the country's first century, taking us from 1919 through the Roaring Twenties, the Great Depression, World War II, and the post-war period, exploring both the joys and pain of everyday life. From the very beginning, Capra knew that he wanted to cast Jimmy Stewart in the role of George Bailey. They had already worked together on two hugely successful films, 1938's You Can't Take It With You and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington from 1939. More importantly than their proven track record, Capra wanted Stewart because he knew that the actor, with his relatable, down-home, everyman charm, could pull off both the light and dark aspects of George Bailey's character and convincingly portray a man plummeting into despair. Of all actors' roles, I believe the most difficult is the role of a good Samaritan who doesn't know that he's a good Samaritan. I knew one man who could play it. Jimmy Stewart, said Capra. I got a phone call one day from Frank Capra, Stuart remembered. He said, I have an idea for a story. Why don't you come down and I'll tell it to you? I couldn't get down there quick enough. When I sat down, he said, you're a fella in a small town. Then you get married and have all these kids. And your father dies and you take over the building and loan. And finally, you're going to kill yourself. You're going to jump off a bridge and an angel named Clarence comes down to help you. But he can't swim, so you go down and save. Capra stopped mid-sentence. This really doesn't sound so good, does it? Stuart answered, Frank, if you want me to be in a picture about a guy that wants to kill himself and an angel named Clarence comes down who can't swim and I have to save him, when do we start? Jimmy Stewart was already an established Academy Award-winning Hollywood star, taking home a Best Actor Oscar for 1940's The Philadelphia Story. However, like Capra, Stewart had been absent from the screen for the last 5 years while he served overseas. Stewart had been one of the first actors to voluntarily join the military when the U.S. entered World War II. He enlisted in March 1941, requesting a combat position after initially being assigned to publicity work. Over the course of his military career, Stewart participated in over 20 combat missions, rising to the rank of Brigadier General, making him the highest-ranking actor in military history. Jimmy Stewart officially signed on to the picture on November 5th, 1945. It's a Wonderful Life would serve as something of a comeback film for both Capra and Stewart. Capra prided himself on his ability to find the best performers for every role in his films, no matter how innocuous the part. I have a sixth sense for casting, he once said. I just have to see and talk to the actors. I never make screen tests. Capra's gift for casting is certainly on full display in It's a Wonderful Life, as it is hard to imagine a more perfect cast of characters. Capra would consider 170 actors for the film before finalizing his choices. Claude Rains, Vincent Price, Charles Bickford, Louis Calhern, Victor Joy, Edward Arnold, Edgar Buchanan, Raymond Massey, Thomas Mitchell, and Charles Coburn were just a few of the actors that were considered for Mr. Potter, the evil banker whose greediness would galvanize George Bailey's desperation, before Lionel Barrymore was cast. Barrymore had already worked with both Capra and Stewart on You Can't Take It With You, and had played Ebenezer Scrooge in a popular radio version of A Christmas Carol, which made him a perfect fit for Mr. Potter. Though the film never provides an explanation, Lionel Barrymore was by this time heavily reliant on a wheelchair due to a hip injury and severe arthritis. He chose to play Mr. Potter as a survivor of polio, though that distinction is never mentioned in the script. Thomas Mitchell, known for Gone with the Wind and Stagecoach, for which he won a Best Supporting Actor Oscar, may not have won the role of Mr. Potter, but he did beat out W.C. Fields and Adolph Manju for the role of Uncle Billy, the lovable but forgetful brother of George Bailey's father Peter, who was played by Samuel S. Hines, a former Hollywood lawyer that decided to try his hand at acting after losing all of his money during the stock market crash of 1929. H.B. Warner, who worked with Capra on Mr. Deeds, Lost Horizon, You Can't Take It With You, and Mr. Smith, was cast as pharmacist Mr. Gower, a role that was a welcome departure for the actor, who found himself typecast in straight and narrow, virtuous roles after portraying Jesus in Cecil B. DeMille's 1927 silent film, King of Kings. Warner was thrilled at the opportunity to play Gower, who was drunk in most of his scenes. He was quoted as saying, I'm playing the damnedest, dirtiest bum you ever saw, a proper drunk, thanks to Frank Capra. According to actor Bobby Anderson, who played young George, H.B. Warner was a little too committed to the part, and was actually drunk during the scene where George confronts Mr. Gower over the mistaken prescription. Anderson said that Warner really slapped him hard enough to make his ear bleed, and felt so bad afterwards he gave Anderson a big hug when they completed the scene. Capra wanted Henry Travers to be included in the picture in some capacity, having originally considered him for Uncle Billy, George's father, and Mr. Gower, before eventually casting him as Clarence Oddbody, Angel Second Class. Beulah Bondi had basically become Jimmy Stewart's professional mother by this point, having played the part in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Vivacious Lady, and Of Human Hearts by the time of It's a Wonderful Life's casting. By the end of her career, Bondi would have played Stewart's mother 7 times. Once, when Jimmy Stewart was filming an episode of a television show, he was asked which actress should be cast as his mother. "You've got to get Beulah Bondi," he replied. "She is my mother." Capra's first choice for Mary, George's wife, was Jean Arthur, who he had already worked with on 3 previous films. Arthur was committed to a Broadway play at the time, and therefore was unavailable to do the picture, and the search for the perfect Mary Bailey continued. After Arthur, Capra considered Olivia de Havilland, Martha Scott, Anne Vorschach, and Ginger Rogers. Rogers passed on the role, which she found, quote, too bland. She would later write in her 1991 autobiography, "Foolish, you say?" The role of Mary was a crucial one, as her warmth, beauty, and devotion are meant to show George that staying in Bedford Falls was not a punishment, even if the audience notices it before he does. Capra finally landed on Donna Reed, who up until then had worked as a contract player at MGM. Though she had already been in a number of films, It's a Wonderful Life would be the 25-year-old's first starring role. Casting Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed worked for a number of reasons, one of which being that they both really were from small-town America. Stewart grew up in Indiana, Pennsylvania, the son of a hardware store owner, where Jimmy worked alongside his father as a young man. Donna Reed, born Donna Belle Mullinger from Denison, Iowa, proved herself to be a real country girl when she won a $50 bet against Lionel Barrymore, who challenged her to milk a cow as he did not believe she would know how to do it. Last, but certainly not least, Capra staple Jimmy the Raven even had a part in the film as Uncle Billy's pet. Jimmy would be in more than 1,000 films throughout his career, making his first on-screen appearance in You Can't Take It With You, and having a prestigious cameo in The Wizard of Oz as the bird that lands on the scarecrow. Capra loved Jimmy so much that he made sure that his feathered friend had a part in each of his movies. Jimmy Stewart called Jimmy the Raven the smartest actor on set, as he required the least amount of retakes. "When they call Jimmy, we both answer," said Stewart. The Bedford Falls exterior set was built on the 89-acre RKO Ranch in Encino and would be one of the largest sets ever made for an American film at the time, taking up 4 acres all to itself. Many of the sets were reworked from the 1931 Western, Cimarron, which had once been RKO's most expensive film. Downtown Bedford Falls was 300 feet long, the equivalent of 3 city blocks, and contained 75 different storefronts and buildings, in addition to a residential neighborhood, a factory district, a slum, and a fully operational bank. To give the set a more lived-in touch, dozens of cats, dogs, and pigeons were let loose where they were allowed to roam freely. Capra had 20 real oak trees installed on the set to make the block seem more realistic. In total, the set took 2 months to build. Capra was a big fan of including weather in his films. For 1936's The Lost Horizon, he had the sets refrigerated so that the actor's breath would show up on camera. The Bedford Falls set was far too large for this technique, so Capra had the special effects department and his set decorators come up with different ways to create believable weather conditions. The town of Bedford Falls was certainly a challenge for the set designers, as the town needed to be fully adaptable. The sets would have to age over the course of the film's 27-year time frame and be shown in different seasons and weather. Crew members would even go about removing the leaves from the oak trees for the winter scenes. Their biggest undertaking was the fake snow. The common practice at the time was to use white-painted cornflakes, which looked authentic enough, but were very loud and crunchy, and would always have to be overdubbed afterwards. Not wanting to go that route, Capra sought a new and silent movie snow. Russell Sherman, head of the special effects department at RKO, would come up with exactly what Capra needed. Sherman invented a new chemical snow to be used on the picture, which was a mixture of soap, water, sugar, and fomite, the foam used in fire extinguishers. The solution was shot through a high-pressure hose and then blown upwards by an industrial fan to create the illusion of falling snow. 6,000 gallons of the chemical snow would be used by the production's end, including 3,000 pounds of ice and drywall. The film would have three cinematographers. Capra was not thrilled with Victor Milner, the original cinematographer, who he found to be pretentious and too slow. Joseph Walker from Columbia, who Capra had used on 8 previous films, was brought in to replace Milner. Columbia president Harry Cohn flipped out when he learned that Walker was working with Capra on a film for RKO and demanded that Walker return to Columbia. Before leaving the picture, Walker trained Joseph Byrock, a cameraman from the Army Signal Corps, to take over for him. This would be Byrock's first feature film. Up until then, he'd worked on military documentaries, having filmed the atrocities of the Dachau concentration camp while serving in the Special Motion Picture Coverage Unit during the war. Both Walker and Byrock would be credited for the film. Capra made sure no mention of Milner was made. Filming began on April 15, 1946, and concluded on July 27th, ending exactly on par with its 90-day shooting schedule. The film was shot during the middle of a record-breaking heat wave, which explains why some of the actors are seen perspiring in a few scenes. The weather became so unbearable that Capra once gave the entire cast and crew a full day off to rest. Grueling temperatures aside, filming went off without a hitch. My research didn't turn up any on-set drama or mishaps that led to delays. The production ended on time and according to schedule, and to celebrate, Capra threw a party for the cast and crew. I did, however, learn some interesting pieces of trivia from the making of the film. The scene where George and Mary dance in the Charleston contest along the edge of the pool was called by one film critic, movie fakery at its worst. However, that critic would end up eating his words, as no special effects were required. The scene was shot in the gym of Beverly Hills High School, which is known today as the Swim Gym. The gym floor really does slide back to reveal the pool below, and is still in use at the school to this day. Fun fact, the scorned young man who loses Mary to George Bailey at the dance and opens up the gym floor so that they fall into the pool was played by Carl Switzer, better known as Alfalfa from the R-Gang series, also popularly called The Little Rascals. In the scene where Mary and George throw rocks through the window of the home that will someday be theirs, Frank Capra had a stuntman positioned off-camera to throw the rock for Donna Reed, but he was not needed. Reed actually was a great pitcher, having played on her school's baseball team, and broke the window on her first take. A press release from the Times claimed that the scene where a drunken Uncle Billy calls out, "I'm okay, I am okay," after crashing into something off camera was the product of some timely ad-libbing on Thomas Mitchell's part. The story went that just as Mitchell walked out of frame, a crew member knocked over several items, causing a loud clattering that would have ruined the take. To save the sound, Mitchell allegedly worked with the mishap by adding in his "I'm okays." Now, as much as I like this story, the entire bit, including the crash, is actually in the script. Obviously, the publicity department at RKO never thought the day would come when film scripts would be so easily accessible for the general public to fact-check any of their claims. Jimmy Stewart reportedly begged Capra to delay one of George and Mary's scenes, as he was incredibly nervous about performing the romantic dialogue with Donna Reed. In the scene, George turns down a lucrative job opportunity and chooses to begin a relationship with Mary, sealing his fate to remain in Bedford Falls. Stewart feared that he had been away from the camera for too long and wouldn't know how to pull off the intimacy required for the scene, confessing, "A fella gets rusty." When it came time to eventually shoot the scene, Capra reworked it so that Stewart and Reed would have to share the phone, making sure that Stewart wouldn't be able to run away. The scene was filmed in just one take. Capra was satisfied with it, even when the script supervisor brought it to his attention that they had skipped an entire page of dialogue. Capra replied, "With technique like that, who needs dialogue?" In the scene where the people of Bedford Falls swarm the Bailey building alone to get their money out after the stock market crash of 1929, one woman was supposed to ask George for $40. Unbeknownst to Jimmy Stewart, Capra, at the last minute, told her to ask for $17.50. In an unscripted moment, Stewart, moved by her surprise dialogue, leans down and kisses the woman on the cheek. In one of the film's most emotional scenes, where a despondent George Bailey begs God for a sign, James Stewart became so overcome with emotion that he genuinely started sobbing. Capra was moved by the take and knew he had to use it, reframing it as a close-up and blowing up the footage so that the camera could capture Stewart's emotion. This explains why the quality of this scene is blurrier than the rest of the film. Here's one cool attention to detail that I think is worth mentioning. Earlier on Christmas Eve, we see a close-up of the front page of a newspaper announcing war hero Harry Bailey's return to Bedford Falls, and in the top right corner, snow is predicted for later that day. At the end of the film, when George is begging God to let him live again, it suddenly starts to snow. This is intended to act as our cue that George is back in reality as he knew it. With the film completed, it still had to run the gamut of the censorship board before it could be released. In 1946, the production code of the Motion Picture Association of America was still in full swing, and the censors took issue with pretty much every film. Unsurprisingly, when It's a Wonderful Life was submitted for their review, the production code objected to several words and phrases, including impotent, which appeared somewhere in the script twice, as well as dang, lousy, jerk, and the phrases nuts to you and I wish to God. In addition to asking that this dialogue be removed, they also disapproved of scenes where George was shown to be drunk or drinking excessively, and asked that George and Mary's kiss during the telephone love scene be shortened. Of the scene where George stops his suicide attempt to save the drowning Clarence, the production code wanted it to be expressly clear that both actors were clothed. However, the film violates one of the production code's golden rules, but this offense managed to remain in the final cut. Per the production code's own guidelines, any character that perpetuates a criminal act must be punished by the end of the film. Film historian Andrew Saris, co-founder of the National Society of Film Critics, notes that the censors made no mention that the villainous Mr. Potter gets away with robbery without being caught or punished in any way. Frank Capra would later say that he got more mail about letting Potter off the hook than he did about anything else. Surprisingly, one of the biggest concerns involving the film was whether or not it would be misconstrued as communist propaganda. In a 13,000-page memo from the FBI, which was documenting what they considered to be the communist infiltration of Hollywood, It's a Wonderful Life was specifically signaled out. The FBI noted that known communist Dalton Trumbo had been, to some extent, involved in the picture, and that the film's depiction of George Bailey going up against the wealthy Mr. Potter was, quote, a rather obvious attempt to discredit bankers by having him be the most hated man in the picture. This picture deliberately maligned the upper class, attempting to show people who had money were mean and despicable characters. This is a common trick used by communists. In defense of the film, it can be argued that the Baileys are also financial businessmen who do good for the people of Bedford Falls, like creating affordable housing and running their building and loan service. The dichotomy of the Baileys and Mr. Potter shows how money can be used for both good and evil. Though originally slated for release in March 1947, the world premiere of It's a Wonderful Life was pushed up when Sinbad the Sailor with Douglas Fairbanks, which was RKO's intended December release, fell behind schedule after Technicolor workers had gone on strike. By December 1946, It's a Wonderful Life was the only completed film RKO had to put out. This explains why, in the film's original promotional material, there were no nods to Christmas, as it was not only never thought of as a holiday movie, but was supposed to be released in the spring. The rushed release, which afforded little time to properly promote the film, would hinder its performance at the box office. It's a Wonderful Life premiered at the Globe Theater in New York City on December 20th, 1946. It would be released nationwide on January 7th, where it opened at number 26, one position higher than Miracle on 34th Street. Upon its release, the film received mixed reviews. The New York Times called it a little too sticky for our tastes, further writing, "The weakness of this picture is the sentimentality of it, its illusionary concept of life. Mr. Capra's nice people are charming, his small town a beguiling place, and his pattern for solving problems is most optimistic, but somehow they resemble theatrical attitudes rather than average realities." The New York Republic said, "Capra takes an easy, simple-minded path that doesn't give much credit to the intelligence of the audience." Time magazine gave the film a favorable review, writing, "It is a pretty wonderful movie. Director Capra's inventiveness, humor, and affection for human beings keep it glowing with life and excitement. It has only one formidable rival, MGM's The Best Years of Our Lives, as Hollywood's best picture of the year." The Best Years of Our Lives, a film about World War II vets attempting to return to their civilian lives that was directed by Capra's friend and Liberty Films partner William Wyler, was released just a month before It's a Wonderful Life. The Best Years would earn $11.5 million at the box office and would eventually become the highest-grossing film of the 1940s. It's a Wonderful Life would fail to make back its $3.7 million price tag, coming in short at just $3.3 million in ticket sales, a $525,000 loss for RKO. At the time of the film's release, the East Coast was experiencing sub-zero temperatures along with heavy snow and ice, and the inclement weather was thought to have been the culprit for the film's lackluster turnout. The poor box office reception was a huge disappointment for Capra, with some industry insiders speculating that he had lost his touch when it came to making financially successful, super popular movies. Despite its commercial performance, It's a Wonderful Life was nominated for 5 Academy Awards: Best Actor for Jimmy Stewart, Best Director, Best Sound, Best Film Editing, and Best Picture. It was not nominated in any of the special effects categories, but Russell Sherman was presented with an honorary award for his Chemical Snow. Aside from that, It's a Wonderful Life didn't take home any Oscars. The Best Years would win 7 awards that night, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actor for Frederick March. It was nominated for just 1 Golden Globe that year, Best Director, of which Frank Capra was the winner. By the end of 1947, It's a Wonderful Life had faded from public consciousness and was headed for total obscurity. But audiences would discover the film decades later due to a clerical error, lapsed copyright, and a legal loophole. In 1974, the film's rights belonged to National Telefilm Associates, a company that specialized in the syndication of American films to television. Because of a mistake on the paperwork to renew It's a Wonderful Life's copyright, NTA lost their rights to it, and the film fell into the public domain. This allowed local television stations to play the film whenever they wanted without having to pay royalties. It would first enter televised circulation in December 1976, and within a few years it was a perennial holiday classic, becoming as much of a Christmas tradition as putting up a tree and opening presents. Frank Capra and Jimmy Stewart each began receiving overwhelming volumes of letters from fans asking about the film. More so, claimed Capra, than any of his other movies. This continued well into the 1980s. "It's the damnedest thing," Capra would later say. "The film has a life of its own now. I can look at it like I had nothing to do with it. I'm like a parent whose kid grows up to be president. I'm proud, but it's the kid that did all the work. There's more to the picture than I put in it. There's more to the picture than was written in it. There's more to the picture than we knew what we were playing with, and that we didn't expect." Almost 30 years after it was released in theaters, audiences were finally discovering and falling in love with It's a Wonderful Life. NBC picked up the copyright in 1996 and shows the film every year on Christmas Eve. Not only has it become a beloved Christmas classic, but It's a Wonderful Life has come to be regarded as one of the greatest films ever made. It was voted number 20 on the American Film Institute's Greatest Movies list, and number 1 on their list of the most inspirational films. George Bailey was voted number 9 on AFI's list of the greatest film heroes, with Mr. Potter at number 6 on their list of greatest villains. It's a Wonderful Life is the only film to have characters that ranked within the top 10 on AFI's heroes and villains lists. Even after cementing its place in pop culture history, It's a Wonderful Life is not without its critics. An overwhelming number of people actually find the film incredibly depressing. I must admit, though the film does have a happy ending, it makes you suffer to get there. An interesting criticism I found was from a December 2008 profile in the New York Times, written by editor Wendell Jameson, titled, "Wonderful. Sorry, George. It's a pitiful, dreadful life." In it, Jameson calls the film a terrifying, asphyxiating story about growing up and relinquishing your dreams, of seeing your father driven to the grave before his time, of living among bitter, small-minded people. It's a story of being trapped, of compromising, of watching others move ahead and away, of becoming so filled with rage that you verbally abuse your children, their teacher, and your perfect wife. The film critic I mentioned earlier, Saris, also said, "It is one of the most profoundly pessimistic tales of human existence to ever achieve a lasting popularity." Going back to Jameson from the New York Times, his piece does bring up a pretty good, undeniable point, noting that despite the townsfolk helping George raise the missing $8,000, he still probably would have faced jail time in the real world. If someone robs a bank and then gives the money back, that person still robbed a bank, Jameson writes. Despite any detractors, James Stewart, Donna Reed, and Frank Capra all considered It's a Wonderful Life to be their favorite out of all of the films they had worked on. "I thought it was the greatest film I had ever made," Capra would later say. "Better yet, I thought it was the greatest film anybody had ever made. I love that film. It's my favorite film. And in a sense, it epitomizes everything I had been trying to do and say in the other films, only very dramatically, with a very unique story. The importance of the individual is the theme that it tells, that no man is a failure, that every man is born to do something." As Jimmy Stewart said, "I've had such wonderful, good fortune in my life, and I think that this is one of those pieces of good fortune that I have and that I'll never forget." The film reminds us of the power of our actions, both big and small, and that each of us, whether we realize it or not, are already making a difference. Most importantly, it reminds us that life is always worth living. I think as time goes by, it will become more popular, Capra very fortuitously said, because it's a theme that hits everybody. Everybody has gone through that thing when they would rather live than die. That's why the picture will live on. Like George Bailey, It's a Wonderful Life experienced highs and lows, and in the end, was rescued by the people that loved it. Okay, there we have it, the making of It's a Wonderful Life. I really hope you guys liked this episode. I had a lot of fun making it. If you're not already, please follow me on Instagram at ThePicturesGotSmall and let me know how you feel about this film. I'm curious to know how many people love it versus how many hate it. And also, don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcasts. And before I go, I just want to say happy holidays to everyone. I hope 2021 is much kinder to all of us. I hope we all have a good year. And as always, of all the podcasts on all the smartphones, on all the streaming platforms in all the world, I'm certainly glad you found mine. I'm Francesca Luisi, and this has been The Pictures Got Small.
Oh, why did I have to fall in love with such a fool?
I ran into a story for you, a front page story.
Gus, you're a dear, sweet boy, and you'll bring my little present.
I happen to know the police are looking for this car.
Oh, dear, I hoped you wouldn't.
You heard me say no, didn't you? Well, that's what I mean.
See here, I told you I wasn't asking anything from anybody. I can take care of myself.
Maybe you have, but do you think I want to stay cooped up in this place any longer than I have to?
Well, this is one of the biggest stories that's cracked in a long time. I've simply got to get it to my paper.
No worry about that. We've got all the time in the world.
Thank you for listening to The Pictures Got Small. Remember, Hollywood was glamorous and sometimes dark.